providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And as promised in the second half of this weekend show, we are going to be shifting our focus more to the resource sector and even more so to some of the resource equities as we are chatting with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Now, Matt, let's get right into it on more of a broad topic here of how the junior mining markets, especially the junior stocks, how they relate to the broader equity markets. Simply because, look, I know a lot of people are always saying, well, you can have your money in the broad markets, and if the markets are going up, then people don't necessarily come down to some of the resource stocks. But when you deal with the juniors, that is more of a risk-on trade. So usually if you see U.S. markets moving higher, especially different sectors of those markets, then it means investors are getting or have more tolerance for risk. So maybe they will go down into some of these junior stocks. How, from a high level, do you see the balance of the push and pull, where investors' money goes between the broad equity markets, what they're doing, and then if it filters down into the junior equities?
Good to be back on the program, Corey, and I hope you and Shad have had a good summer, both of you. I guess just looking at the broader markets and then turning to the relationship with the junior markets, I think at this point it's hard to argue that at least in the broader indices, particularly in the U.S., that we are not in a bull market at this point. You know, there are a few supporting points for this. The first is that all three major U.S. indices are well above the, you know, 20% threshold that is used to determine a bull market, and that's off of the October 2022 lows. So we've seen that both in the S&P, the Dow, and the NASDAQ. You know, the second point is that this move has now been going on for upwards of 11 months. And if you look at past bear markets, I guess if you're trying to decide between whether we are in a, you know, quote unquote new bull market or in a bear market rally, if you look at past bear market rallies, this is two times longer than any we've seen historically, at least in the United States over the past 100 years. If you look at the Great Crash, you know, which began in 1929, the longest bear market rally we saw in that, you know, painful, drawn out bear market was 5 months. In the Nifty 50 bust, the longest bear market rally we saw was 1 month. In the dot-com bust, we also saw a five-month bear market rally. So that was a bit on the longer end of things. And in the great financial crisis, the longest bear market rally we saw was 2 months. So we're at 11 at this point, more than double the longest we saw in either the great crash or the dot-com bust earlier this century. So that signals to me that at least technically, and, you know, some would say this is just semantics, but I think we can say that we are in a bull market. And then also from a TA perspective, which I don't put a huge amount of weighting on, but we have broken above the 0.786 Fibonacci line, which I'm told is a key technical litmus test for whether we're just seeing a counter trend move or whether we're in a true bull market. So I do think at least for the broader markets, we can say that. Also on the broader market front, I mean, really over the past 45 years, the playbook that we've seen play out time and time again is, you know, a 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 year bull market ended by a sharp, you know, violent drawdown. You know, think of the great financial crisis, for instance, or almost what we saw last year as well, where we saw in 6 months a 30% drawdown amongst the major indices, then followed again by another 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 year bull market. So I think a lot of participants in the market have kind of taken this pattern to be reality and are assuming that the same thing is going to play out here. I will say that it's quite possible that this pattern does repeat. And, you know, perhaps it truly will be peaches and cream, you know, in the broader markets for the next, you know, 4 or 5 years or even longer. You know, that said, that is certainly not my base case as an investor. You know, I actually think it's pretty wild, in fact, how many, you know, financial prognosticators and talking heads are out there, you know, declaring a soft landing and, you know, celebrating how the Fed has handled this. Really, anybody that's followed past rate hike cycles and how the broader and how financial markets have responded to them knows that typically the collapse in prices of financial assets occurs upon the first cut and during the hiking phase, let alone the pause phase. And again, we're in the hiking phase still, and have yet to even get to the pause phase. So I think it's quite early to declare victory. So as one would guess, even though I would argue we are in what can be considered a bull market at this point, my base case is that we'll see either a lower high relative to the previous all-time highs reached across the U.S. indices, or a potential double top. So I'm not assuming that we're about to blast off to all-time highs and never look back again. That's definitely within the realm of possibility, but I think it's foolish, perhaps delusional, but at least, you know, overly aggressive to assume that that's going to happen again this time around. So then the question is, what does this mean for juniors? Of course, if we do see the old pattern repeat and we see the market launch to all-time highs convincingly, I could see a broad-based junior rally occur. But I think that we need to see convincing all-time highs. My base case, and kind of some of the cautiousness that I have, at least from broader market activity, is I think we most likely need to see a pretty sharp drawdown in the broader markets that would be reflected in junior markets before we really see the juniors move en masse. And so what does that mean from a junior perspective? I mean, I guess one approach could be to sell all your junior holdings and sit in cash and wait for a sunny day to deploy. You know, that's a mug's game. I would not recommend that for anybody. But, you know, with this in mind, perhaps one could, you know, reset expectations psychologically with the understanding that, you know, before we see the next major move in juniors, we may need a little sharp pain to occur first. You know, an investor could focus on the names with defined downside protection. And you can view that through a few different lens, but one of the more obvious ones is look at a company's net working capital, basically their liquidation value, and how far the share price would have to fall from current levels before it's at that liquidation value. And then another approach would be to keep a bit of a cash buffer to provide courage and conviction for when we next see the sharp drawdown. And of course, the risk of going all in on cash is that things don't play out to plan, which they often don't. But I think kind of hedging it with a 10, 20, 25% cash waiting to save for a rainy day makes a good amount of sense. And yeah, in the meantime, my view is that it's going to be a stock picker's market. There are juniors out there that are working. Obviously, the post-discovery plays are kind of a prime example. You know, looking at the snow lines and collective minings of the world, I've been very impressive. More recently, American West, the ASX-listed vehicle, and their partner Aston Bay on the TSXV, it's really caught the junior mining world by storm, so to speak, with their storm project up in Nunavut. So there are ways to make money in this market, but I think it's a bit foolish to assume that the juniors as a bunch are going to blast higher, you know, anytime in the near term without some pain first to reset things.
Well, Matt, just along that line of thinking, a lot of people conflate their approach to the general markets, like what they would take in the S&P 500 or the Dow or the NASDAQ, and how they invest in commodity cycles. So you hear a lot of people that are talking about buy and hold, which is great if you're in the equity markets and there's hundreds of years of track record where you see the markets generally creep higher over time. And after corrective moves come giant expansion periods in the markets. But commodities have always been cyclical. If you look at oil and gas, if you look at gold and silver, if you look at base metals, if you look at grains, they're all cyclical. They all go up and down. And within those, it's almost always a stock picker's market because it's very rare that you see years or decades of a rising tide lifting all boats. So maybe just speak to, as someone that's been in the space a while, how you approach the stock picking side of it, because it's not something where you can just hope that you throw your money in a couple dozen juniors and that they're all going to go up together. That's just unlikely, and that's not the pattern we've ever seen play out before.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's a key point to emphasize. I mean, yeah, there have been periods where we have seen very broad-based moves occur for 6, 9, even 12-month periods. You can think of the major rally and actually the junior space at large, I would say, particularly precious metals in you know, 2016, early 2016 through fall of 2016. Another period where basically anything with gold in the company's name, saw major moves was the post COVID crash period. So we'll say late spring, you know, through fall of 2020. And then on, you know, kind of the critical minerals side of things, 2021 was a very strong year, largely across the board. We've seen lithium continue to perform in the year since. But a lot of the other, you know, critical minerals that participated in that 2021 year rally have certainly petered off, as have the equities focused on them. So I think that is an important point. It's never it's never a good idea to assume that there's going to be any broad-based junior buying frenzy. They do occur, but it's better to be pleasantly surprised than to be expecting that to be the case.
Do you put any credence in that argument that a crashing U.S. market will just flat out draw investors not just into the metals, but because maybe metals go higher, then they'll also chase the stocks?
I mean, in the immediate aftermath, but we've been through a few major drawdowns in broader markets here over the past, you could say, just few years, you know, or 6 or 7 years at this point. But even physical gold, which is, you know, definitely a beneficiary of a bear market, even physical gold gets hit hard right off the bat. So, you know, and it's possible that this could play out differently in the future. There's, you know, this is not an immutable law of nature. But the obvious assumption is that any time that there's a major drawdown in the broad markets, it is going to be reflected, at least in the immediate term, in the prices of both metals and any, you know, mining equities focused on those metals. So it could be good in the medium or long term. And I would argue for precious metals in particular, it would be good in the medium to long term to see a sharp drawdown in broader markets. But that doesn't protect you from short term pain by any means. And it's important for folks to keep that in mind. I know, you know, investors that are new to gold and silver that, you know, are maybe right in the medium to long term are often shocked at how painful it can be when the broader market draws down. But, you know, one has to keep their wits about them and also, you know, keep history in mind that these moves do take time to play out. And you need to be comfortable weathering some pretty significant volatility.
Well, Matt, the other thing that's kind of interesting, I guess, and even somewhat concerning in the retail space of the junior mining stocks, not just for gold and silver, but even in the base metals, is oftentimes when the commodities make a run, of course, higher prices bring more interest, more headlines. A lot of the companies do benefit. But it seems like every time we've seen a rally, let's just pick gold, for example, in gold, the rally that we saw from 2009 through 2011 really was more of a rising tide lifting all boats kind of environment. And the valuations we saw in those metals when gold got up above 1900, 1921-ish, we've never seen those valuations again. When gold got up to over 2000 again in the year 2020, the stocks did rally, but their valuations are nowhere close to what they were back then. Same thing with that 2016 rally you referenced. And then when we saw gold get above 2000 two more times in 2022 and then again this year, same thing. The miners did respond, all of them, or some of them. Some of the juniors didn't move at all. But they keep getting to lower highs each time. It's almost like a ball bouncing, and it's not bouncing as high as it keeps continuing to bounce every time the gold price moves there. What kind of a price breakout do we need to see in some of these metals to really get some traction where the miners get valued at a more reasonable level or levels they've had in the past?
No, that's right. And I mean, everything you're saying there is accurate. I guess it's all in the eye of the beholder, though. You know, many investors participating in the junior space right now are frustrated by those very factors that you point out. I'm actually excited by them because I think that provides an opportunity. And I included an interesting chart in the latest MJG investor letter, which is available on our website at mjgcapital.com. It's right in the introduction section. Some data provided by Sprott. Looking at the relative valuation discrepancy between juniors and the senior miners, and it's wider than it's been at any point this century. Yes, that's frustrating. Yes, something could be permanently broken, and this time is different. I don't think that's the case. I think at some point during this decade, that gap will be bridged to the benefit of those that have had the patience and the stomach to continue to hold juniors over the period. So I don't think anything is irreparably broken, but I think each of the points you make are accurate. You know, to your question, what do we need to see for this to resolve? Look, I mean, in the precious metal space, I think psychologically we'll just have to see precious metals surge to all-time highs. And I think we do see that at some point during this decade. But I'm not foolish enough to put out a price or, sorry, a timing prediction of when that's going to occur. But I do think we do see gold break convincingly above 2100 at some point in these coming years. We'll then see the senior miners, if they haven't already, very likely rally to, you know, all-time highs or at least, you know, cycle highs in the aftermath of that. And then the juniors will follow. So I do think it comes, but to your point earlier, you know, as we wait, this could be a multi-year process. It could also happen next year. Again, these are just reading the tea leaf type scenarios. But I think there's money to be made within the juniors, within specific juniors, you know, from a stock picking perspective, while we wait for that. But if you're buying a broad basket of juniors and crossing your fingers and hoping gold goes to 2100 in the next 6 months, you know, that's probably not the way to go about it.
Oh, we've seen that play out over and over again, right? With people saying, oh, you just play the basket, right? It's just take a shotgun approach, buy everything and everything will go higher. But boy, oh boy, that doesn't seem to happen very much. Tying the lack of interest in the junior stocks, everyone can look at the volume, which is low, the share prices, which have been depressed. And another factor that we've touched on a number of times is private placements. It's a tough financing environment out there. Companies are having a lot of trouble raising money. I know you're seeing this as well, but do you see this changing? What changes this environment?
I don't think it does change. I think it gets tougher, and we probably see issuer capitulation occur. I mean, obviously it's been super quiet, as one would expect, over these summer months. So there haven't been a lot of deals done at any terms, but you know, that will change here, you know, post Labor Day, particularly with the Beaver Creek conference coming up in a couple weeks' time now. So I do expect us to enter into a window of issuer capitulation. It's really been close to 18 months now since the junior market was last rocking and rolling. And I would say it wasn't a terrible time to be in the space, you know, in the immediate aftermath of Russia's invasion of Ukraine in spring of 2022. But really, it's been ugly across the space, you know, maybe with lithium and a few, you know, select discovery plays, you know, in the 18 months since. And of course, for precious metals, it's been, you know, tougher, you know, even longer than that. The juniors that were really working in spring of 2022 were much more on the critical minerals side of things. So we're talking 18 months plus of tough times. Yeah, and it's getting to the point where companies that were even well capitalized, you know, back last spring are now, you know, getting lower on cash and maybe aren't absolutely desperate for capital, but are getting to the point where they're not going to be able to complete any potential catalysts or answer any unanswered questions without raising additional money. So my expectation is that half warrants will become absolutely obligatory, and that, you know, we'll also see the return of long dated full warrants potentially, you know, without accelerators. And, you know, that's obviously going to be dismaying to any issuer or any CEO that knows they need to raise money in the coming months. But look, there's going to be a lot of mouths to feed, you know, sentiments as low as I've seen it in years within the junior space. It's not as bad as I've ever seen it. You know, thinking back to 2014, 2015, this still feels like child's play to me. But the narrative out there is very negative at the moment when it comes to juniors. And I think, look, it's going to provide a window for some opportunistic deals between now and the end of the year. Of course, for those that don't play in private placements for one reason or another, they may not be accredited. It may just not be their investment style. You know, this is even a further reason to focus on names that have multiple years of runway and or even cash flow positive. You know, there are juniors out there. You have to search for them. You know, they're few and far between, but there are juniors out there that can credibly say that they do not need a raise for another 2, 3, 4 years, or are cash flow positive in a couple unique circumstances. So, you know, that would be the two things. If you participate in placements, buckle up and get ready for some potentially interesting deals, of course, you know, remaining discerning. And if you're not able to invest in placements for one reason or another, given how tough it is out there, really emphasize runway when you're looking at a potential new investment. And if the company you like, it checks all the boxes, but they have to raise in the next 6 months, like, why buy in the open market right now? Might as well sit back, wait for the raise to be completed, see how much is raised, at what terms, who comes in. And if it looks good at that point, you can then buy in the open market. But as a good rule of thumb, any retail investors that can't participate in placements, it's really best to focus on the juniors that you're pretty sure aren't going to have to raise for a number of years to come.
Yeah, Matt, it's so crucial to see that runway you're talking about with companies, because we have seen a couple dozen companies that have gotten their projects financed and did it without even issuing warrants, and a lot of them have. And there's a 1,000 companies that are still waiting to get financed. So it brings up the question, does the whole sector need to look at different ways of doing it? For the exploration stocks and even the development stage stocks, they're all pre-revenue companies. They're not making any money. They're only burning through money. The question is there maybe too many companies spending millions of dollars to poke holes in the ground? We need a discovery, but are there maybe too many companies? Do we need to see more M&A in the space and a roll-up of some of these companies to consolidate projects? And or is there a third option available? Like, I'm thinking of a deal that you may be familiar with. The news came out that Franco-Nevada and EMX Royalty are going to start doing microfinancing with royalties on exploration companies to try to tap into the need for explorers to raise capital without being so dilutive to existing shareholders. Do you have any thoughts on the sector health and maybe what needs to happen to either have less companies or more M&A or maybe more ways to finance these projects?
Yeah, no, you make some good points. I would argue no matter where we are in the cycle, there are always too many juniors. But I would also say when times are tough, the sector's often a little bit better behaved than it is in the rip-roaring bull markets of time past. So look, more consolidation is always better. And one should always assume that, you know, 7 or 8 out of every 10 juniors that they look at are lifestyle juniors. Doesn't mean the CEOs are, you know, bad people per se or what have you, but it just means that it's not worthy of your investment dollars. So I think you should always go in with that lens. Yeah, it's your broader point. I mean, you know, encumbering a exploration or development stage project with a royalty is not a great option. But for these juniors starved of capital, I mean, you're choosing between multiple bad options. And so I think royalty financing should at least be on the table. And if I were a junior that needed to raise capital in the coming 6 months, I would go out and survey the options. I don't like taking loans from bigger shareholders. That is a phenomenon that we've seen quite a bit of. That's my least favorite of the options. But, you know, that can be put on the table. You know, a second option being put on the table, of course, could be raising a private placement, potentially having to include a full warrant, which is painful, but that's just the state of play. And then the third option, as you said, would be, you know, selling a royalty, or, you know, originating a royalty with one of these junior or even senior players and bringing in cash that way. You know, one example that we saw of Hot Chili did that recently. They brought $15 million into the till. I believe this was last month, transacting with the Cisco Gold Royalties. So it all comes down to cost of capital. And if a management team's, you know, doing their job diligently, they're going to look at all three of these options. They're going to put them on the table, and then they're going to make a decision to go from there. And of course, the other option would be to hunker down. And, you know, that's difficult for a lot of these groups to do. But sometimes minimizing burn, sitting on what cash you have and waiting for a better day can be the best strategy. So that should also be on the table for any of these groups. Of course, you know, there are some cases where there's spend commitments or, you know, a whole host of other reasons where money has to be raised. So that may not be an option for all juniors. But I think that should also be one of the options on the table. But no, I don't blame EMX and Franco. I do think it is a good time to go out there and try to originate some royalties on earlier stage projects. And these are going to be smaller deals. You know, these won't be 50 million plus royalty deals to, you know, help build a mine. These will be 2, 5, 7, $10 million deals to help, you know, a junior answer one or two unanswered questions without having to dilute in equity markets with the full warrant. So again, from a junior perspective, put all the options on the table, you know, look at the cost of capital objectively for each of them, and then make your decision from there.
So Matt, I have to say, it doesn't sound like it's going to be all that easy of a market environment here for, let's just say, the wide range of juniors that we have in the resource sector, at least your outlook on it. But you did make the comment that you do see some opportunities out there. There are stocks that can do well still in this higher metal price environment, even if interest is low in the broad sector, the junior sector. What do you look for then? Can you isolate a few things? Can you even isolate maybe a couple stocks that really stand out to you as good examples of companies doing it right that can still outperform?
Sure. And yeah, these aren't recommendations, and everybody has their own kind of an investment framework. But look, I mean, I mentioned earlier using liquidation value as kind of a rough proxy for downside. And there are multiple groups out there, and one of them I have talked publicly about, I believe on this program, if not on other programs, but I'll mention it again, Almadex Minerals. you know, is a name that's trading, I guess it's traded up a little bit over the past couple of days, but, you know, is trading 15 to 25% below its cash breakup value. And you get some equity stakes, you get some active partnerships, you get a 100% owned project with the resource, and you get some, you know, a handful of potentially valuable royalties down the line, all for free. So I like those types of opportunities, particularly in this market environment, because you do have a sense that downside is muted. Of course, again, there's no immutable law of nature that says a company trading 15% you know, below cash at breakup value can't drop to 30% below cash breakup value. So, you know, there still is downside inherent in such stories, but it's just far different value proposition from, you know, a junior, you know, trading or valued, you know, at 20x its cash position, or put another way, having, you know, cash and marketable securities only covering, you know, 5% of market cap. So that's one very clear metric that I would look at. I guess the delta between cash and marketable securities and the company's current market cap. And then I mentioned runway as well. Oftentimes for these types of stories, those will come hand in hand. So as one would imagine, at least in the case of Almedex, you know, they can go literally a decade plus at their current burn rate, but before they have to even consider raising capital. So you can kind of get two bangs for your buck there with these types of stories. I mean, heck, I was just in, you know, St. John's, Newfoundland, visiting with the Altius Minerals team. You know, that's another story that I haven't written about in the MJG investor letter, but have talked publicly as one of our positions, one of our core positions, I would add. And, you know, a group like Altius, I would argue, is one of the few, you know, true buy and holds in the mining space. You know, a lot of our positions, I really like the people, I like the story. It would only take one or two negative news releases. It could be bad luck. It could be bad decision by management. It could be combination thereof that could make me change my mind quickly on the story. But, you know, and Altius is one of the few names out there that you can buy some shares and tuck it away. And, you know, if you look at, you know, subtract out the value of their equity stakes, of their cash position, of some of their non-producing royalties, I mean, this is a group that's, you know, trading at a single-digit cash flow multiple, you know, and it would need to triple or quadruple from here to be trading at the same multiples that we see amongst the larger precious metal royalty companies. So that's another, you know, that's another type of story, obviously vastly different than an Almedex. But again, it checks those boxes that I've just touched on. You know, 40% of Altius's market cap is covered by its cash and equity positions. They're not going to have to raise money. Of course, they could if there's a deal, an opportunistic deal that they really wanted to hop on. But if they don't want to do any new royalty acquisitions, they can go indefinitely. I mean, they're printing between $60 to $80 million a year with their currently producing royalties. So that's another example, entirely different story from Almedex, but still checks those two key boxes. You know, some definable downside. It's not going to fall 90% from current levels like some juniors could, worst comes to worst. And also plenty of runway, if not infinite runway, before they'd even have to consider doing a working capital refresh.
All right. Matt, always great chatting with you. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts on this sector. More a broad-based look, as I know still a lot of investors that have been in this sector are in this sector, still wondering what it is going to take to revalue these stocks just somewhere closer to where the underlying metals prices are. But it does just come down a lot to sentiment and interest, and clearly there just still isn't that much, or people just aren't that sucked into the sector yet. Maybe it'll happen, but hey, you gave us some good things to look for, at least in terms of companies that will be around for the long run. So Matt, thank you for your time. Everybody, thanks for tuning in on this weekend show. Please be sure to go back through our website and podcast, listen to all the daily editorials and company updates from this week, and we will be back with you early in the week. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend, and thanks again for joining us.